I came to talk about engineering and about invention because there never was such an opportunity in the history of the world to do new things with new techniques that we have today. There's nothing in the world that will keep you from doing any type of thing that there's a necessity for. Now we sometimes get tangled up in these things. We give names to things. For instance, we talk about the great power industry. Well, in all the central stations in the United States, there's something like 60 million horsepower installed. In the 42 million cars that are out on the highways, if you count them only at 50 horsepower per car, which is much less than the advertised rating, you can have 2 or 3 billion horsepower installed. And that power industry is perfectly terrific. That has changed our whole method of thinking. That has made it possible for us to move around. Fellow said, nobody knows why he goes over there. There's just as many people going down the road on Sundays as there is coming up. So if they just all stayed at home, it'd just wash out. But they don't do that. But nevertheless, in the particular phase that I've been interested in, various phases of internal combustion engines, we've seen that go from a very simple, elementary type of engine up to these modern types of machines. Many years ago, I tried to understand the thermodynamics of an engine, and I found out that the Lord hadn't given me any kind of a brain that would get that stuff at all. So I come to the conclusion I was going to ask the engine. I did learn what the second law of thermodynamics was, though. I got that one straight. Second law of thermodynamics says you can't push on something that's going faster than you are. But the first and the third, I couldn't get those at all. So we thought it would be a good thing just to ask the engine about this. What did it like about the thing? And we began to do that, and we found out some very interesting things. We found out that in our particular kind of engines, that we were dealing with just two factors. One was what we would call mechanical efficiency. That is, how much do we use up turning the engine itself? And the next is combustion efficiency. Now, combustion efficiency is how hot can you get the gas above the piston? If you get ambitious and try to get it too hot, it radiates to the cylinder wall and it comes out cooler. So you have to get it just as hot as you can for any given kind of a fuel. And when an engine detonates, you're heating the cylinder wall, and that's gas, very largely. And so our first work on ethyl gasoline, or these modified high-test gas, is to get the gas hotter and the cylinder wall cooler. Well, when we begin to pursue that line, we begin to gain on the thing. You must remember, it's hard for you to believe that there was a time when gasoline was a drug on the market, and they used to pay people $100 and overcoat it, they get rid of a few thousand gallons in the river without getting caught by the game warden. And you can see that we came into our picture without any hard pressing of the economics of the thing. So it took a long while for us to gather the idea that you could make these engines economical and that you could do quite interesting things. The diesel engine came along, and that was supposed to be a very, very efficient thing. I don't know whether you know the history of the diesel engine, but I'm going to tell it to you for just a minute. It was developed by the Polynesians. They've been great inventors, the South Pacific Islanders. They've developed a number of very interesting navigation instruments in which they use gourds with water in the gourds and holes drilled in, so they look through the neck of it at a particular star, and that's a pretty good navigation apparatus. And they invented the diesel principle. Now, the American Indians struck a flint to get a fire. Some of them rubbed sticks together to get a fire. The Polynesians took a section of bamboo about that long, fitted a little piston to it with a string as a piston ring, drilled a hole in the end of it and put a little moss in there and did that. And they compressed the air hot enough to set the moss fire. And those were known as fire pistons, and the Polynesians had been using those for 500 or 600 years. And Rudolf Diesel saw one of those fire pistons in the Deutsches Museum in Munich, and he said, I'm going to make an engine like that. Now, if you ever go to England and go to the Bryan and May, the big match people, you'll see hundreds of these fire pistons of all different types that have been used for years and years for making fire. So, the diesel engine was supposed to be a very, very economical type of machinery. And much was written about it, only we didn't see them. So I used to go to Europe every year, and I knew all the diesel designers over there. And I found that they had been thrown into a very difficult situation. When the diesel engine was first developed, they wanted to use it for ship propulsion. And so they took a steam engine out and wouldn't change the propeller or the shaft. So the diesel engine had to work like a steam engine. So for about 20 years, they made them like steam engines. Consequently, they got the reputation for being very, very heavy and very, very slow and very, very everything. And then after a while, they started to put them in automobiles. Then they began to make them like gasoline engines. And they did that for about 20 years. Well, we came on the picture, not with any intention of ever making diesel engines at all, but we said of what we'd found out about combustion from the studying of ethyl gas and so forth, then the way it was being done wasn't quite right. We finally decided to see how a diesel engine would work if we made it like a diesel engine once, instead of like something else. So we find it's very much easier to do something if we do it like something else than if we do it the way the apparatus wants to be. In these engineering possibilities, we sometimes, and I'm using this little story here as an illustration, but in this thing here, the engineering inhibition was that somebody wrote something down about this. And remember, the earlier in an industry you write the thing down, the more likely you are to be wrong. And so they wrote down the theory of the diesel engine. There isn't enough money in the world to make a diesel engine work like the theory. It just can't be done. So we thought that after we started to make one of these work like a diesel engine, we'd see what we could do. Well, we were told they had to be big and they had to be heavy. And slow speed, well, they don't have to be. They don't have to be any bigger and heavier than any other engine for the same horsepower output, unless you think they do. Remember, a machine is what you think it ought to be, not what the machine wanted to be itself. Consequently, if you think the engine ought to be big and heavy, it'll be big and heavy. And so we get into these grooves, these inhibitions, and we run in. We've had that in every phase of the automobile industry that we had to start from scratch here. You can remember it was a 4-horsepower gasoline engine, had a couple of flywheels this high, and turned a couple of 100 revolutions a minute. Quite a far cry from some of those engines that we have now that are 150 horsepower and weigh 400 or 500 pounds. But it came from the same principle. Once you get the principle of the thing, then you can begin to work on the mechanism. When Dr. Ridenour was mentioning about the antenna moving thing, and about the fact that the American shoe machinery company made it look like a piece of shoe machinery, and the Chrysler motor car people didn't do that, he touched one of the most important things in engineering. The shoe machinery company didn't have to get out a yearly model. In other words, learning how to make changes is one of the most important things we have in this whole United States. Dean Potter was speaking about our ability to do things. Well, the one thing that we can do is to make changes. In other words, they were trades experts. They made shoe machinery, and they didn't have to make yearly models. So anything didn't have to make yearly models. So anything they made was going to be like a shoe machine. In the automobile business, we have to make anything. And we make yearly models. Consequently, when you brought them a new model of thing, they made that the way they thought you wanted it made, and it wasn't tied into anything else. So your ability to make change, if you were writing, we talk about our national our resources and so forth. If you write those down, you're amazed to find out what they are. Well, one of our great natural resources in here, right at this location we're standing, is the fact that we're not too far from the 40th parallel of north latitude. And that's one of the greatest natural resources we have, because we have winter and summer. Sometimes just winter and summer, and no spring or fall. The greatest natural resource, of course, we have is the sun. As long as the sun shines and everything happens to us, if we go cold or starve to death, it's our fault, because all the energy we got here on the earth came from the sun. We're all the time talking about exhausting our natural resources. A fellow handed me a little paper the other day which said that 95% of all of our coal was still in the ground. Well, of course, John Lewis helped a little bit on that. But 90% of our petroleum, 90% of our gas, of course, all of our shale oil and all of our tar sands are still available there. And of course, they're nothing but the deposits that the sun made in our great national bank over the billions of years which has been going on. Now we have another asset, is the fact that we could raise, if we had to, enough fuel to run all of the things that we need and right on our farm. We have to learn a few things yet. You use up about the weight of your automobile per year in gasoline. You burn 600 gallons of gasoline, that's about 2 tons. I think that we know how to raise 2 tons of equally good fuel off an acre of ground. We know how to raise the material now, but we don't know how to convert it, because the alcohol way isn't too good, because you lose a lot, even if you don't drink it. You lose a lot by putting that oxygen in there that makes it in alcohol. So we never need to be worried about running out of fuel, so you can go ahead and make any plans you want to. And that's one of the great opportunities that we have. Because the ability to have unlimited power to do the multiple things is assured. Now you're out here in one of the great farming districts of the country. People wonder how we can keep raising so much food. Then we get these despair people. We have two kinds of people, the fear and despair people. And any time you do anything good, well, one of them tells you that something's going to happen to you, something awful bad, too. So the fear and despair people say that we're just ruining our land. Well, I don't know whether you know this or not, but in the last 25 or 30 years, the horse and mule population of this country has gone down 17 million. Now, for every horse and mule you don't feed, you can feed about 4.5 people. Which means that we can raise, without another acre of farming, we can feed 80 million more people. Now, I know that's a little hard on the horses and mules, but nevertheless, those are the economic statistics that go along with that thing. Now, with DDT and 2,4-D and so forth, we're cutting off the feed for the insects, too, so that we can easily get up to another 100 million people without increasing our farming land any at all. And I don't think that we're hardly started on that. Well, of course, you say you're going to exhaust the land. And we say, exhaust it from what? Well, then we get the chemists and the agricultural chemists and so forth. And then we got, you said there's no religion in science and engineering. You ought to get to talking between the mineral fertilizer people and the compost people. And then you know what, and the fishworm group is what a fishworm group does. That is, if you don't have the holes in the soil, why, it's no good. And so, but we with mineral fertilizers today, we can keep right on doing for a long while. But finally, they say we run out, and that shows that it's wrong. Well, out in the country where I come from, out in Ohio, I come from the hills of Ohio, and we had a long time before we'd get alfalfa to grow there. I don't know whether it's suspicious or whether the ground wasn't right, but it was a long while before we got to go. And then we had a rule there that you could cut your alfalfa for 4 years and you had to plow it up.